Eternity is not monolithic. Here it was, crossing and crisscrossing like tracks in a railroad freight yard. All that some whites could see was this roaring steam engine of enmity directed at them, but the truth was, if they cared to look closer, that the black community, unlike its neighbors across the way, held heated and vigorous debates around the issue of race. Where someone like Allen saw salvation within the black community, where he saw the possibility of a separate but equal calculus, others had never lost sight of the prize, racial integration, a sharing of ideas and of resources. Allen believed they were after him because he was an outspoken black man. Others thought him a charlatan, who cared little for the district's students and, with no real defense against the embezzlement charges, could only cry racism. On Tuesday, May 30th, voters, by a 2-to-1 margin, chose to retain Waltman and Ertman. Again, the predominantly white precincts in the school district far outvoted the heavily black precincts. Ultimately, only 200 absentee ballots were cast, and they were equally divided between those for recall and those against. 1 week later, after weeks of hearings, after the disclosure of a state police investigation, after the testimony of the accountant and the detective, the school board, by a vote of 4-3, fired Sherwin Allen. Gladys Peoples Burke voted with the three white board members. The state police never filed any charges against Sherwin Allen. Allen, who appealed his dismissal, left Menton Harbor and took work as a consultant with, among others, Chicago's public schools. Dan Ertman stepped down after his term ended. In 2 years after Allen's departure, the state of Michigan became so distressed at the continuing downward spiral of Benton Harbor's schools that it threatened to take them over. But what lingered long afterward was a thought expressed many times, both by Allen's supporters and by his detractors. It was whispered at the hearings and shouted at a rally. It was hurled at a local reporter and mentioned as an aside at a Rotary Club meeting. It was this: if the powers that be spent as much energy, time, and money investigating Eric McGinnis's death as they did in dethroning Sherwin Allen, they would have solved Eric's death. For many, the equation was that simple. A connection. Jim Reeves had become a lightning rod for the rancor of Benton Harbor. That had much to do with his being a cop. Officer Friendly is not a familiar icon in the African-American community. On the contrary, law enforcement has often been the enemy or has been viewed that way. In the South, early in the century, sheriffs often turned a blind eye to lynchings and on occasion participated in them. And, of course, more recently, we witnessed on videotape four white Los Angeles police officers assaulting Rodney King, a black motorist they had pulled over for speeding. Only in recent years have police departments made a concerted effort to hire black officers, and when they do, as was the case in Benton Harbor, they are often accused of lowering their standards. Or, as was also the case in Benton Harbor, it is suggested that black officers may be reluctant to arrest their own. So, for many in Benton Harbor, Reeves was just one more apple in the cart, one more white cop insensitive to his neighbors across the river. Reeves would tell people he welcomed any leads or tips. He would ask them for their own theories, and then debunk them with whatever evidence he had. "I just want the facts," he'd say. But the accusations that Reeves had participated in a cover-up stung particularly deep. He would tell me during our numerous visits that people could challenge his prowess if they wanted to. They could second-guess his police work. "But please," he'd implore, "don't doubt his intentions or question his integrity." Reeves took the hits personally, especially those delivered by Ruth, or Ruthie, as he was apt to call her. A few months into the investigation, Reeves realized that he and Ruth, in addition to being parents, had other common ground. For Reeves, it made Eric's case all the more disquieting. It was a Friday night in August, nearly 3 months after Eric's death, and Jim said goodnight to his 5-year-old daughter McKenna as he left for his 25th high school reunion. Reeves had graduated from Benton Harbor High School in 1966, at a time when racial tensions were palpable. The complexion of the student body in Benton Harbor schools had begun to change. In 1961, 10% of the graduating class was black. By 1966, the percentage had doubled. After college, Reeves settled in Fairplain, where he'd grown up, and remained there until just 3 months before Eric's death. when he and Denise, concerned about where their children would attend school, purchased a home in St. Joseph. Nonetheless, he remained a loyal Benton Harbor High School booster and attended most of its home football games, even rooting for the Tigers when they played the St. Joseph Bears. Reeves had enjoyed his high school years and eagerly anticipated the reunion. Dressed in a brightly striped Izod golf shirt and blue blazer, he was one of the first to arrive for the start of the weekend's festivities, a cocktail reception at the St. Joseph River Yacht Club. On the yacht club's second floor, where picture windows overlooked Lake Michigan, Reeves gathered with old friends. They played with time, drinking and jesting and telling stories as if this were a pre-graduation social. As a friend recounted how Reeves' Angora sweater caught fire from a chemistry lab's Bunsen burner, Reeves spotted a familiar face in the boardroom, a nearby alcove. Dressed in a purple nylon jogging suit, she sat in a captain's chair, one among many at a long conference table, her attention far away from the chatter about her. It was Ruth McGinnis. Ruth, too, it turned out, had graduated with the Benton Harbor High School class of 1966. She had not planned to come to the reunion, but her mother, concerned that Ruth had become reclusive since Eric's death, insisted that she get out of the house. It would be good to see old friends, a needed distraction. Besides, her mother stressed, most of the people there wouldn't know about Eric's death. She could, for the first time this summer, talk about something else. So Ruth, reluctantly, had agreed to attend the reunion. Maybe it would get her mind off Eric, at least for a night. Since Eric's death, she would on occasion buy a fifth of brandy on a Friday night, hoping it would fill the endless emptiness of the weekends. She hadn't had any this night, but by the time she arrived, she desperately needed something to calm her jitters. Inside the club, she snaked through the crowd, past faces vaguely familiar, smiled and nodded, and got herself a brandy. Finding a cluster of old friends in the boardroom, Ruth pulled up a chair and began almost immediately to drift away. A short, mustached man, slightly tipsy, approached her. Ruth sat upright. "What are you doing here?" she asked accusingly, believing he had come to question her. "I went to school with you." Reeves extended his hand in greeting. Ruth looked at him with disbelief. "Who are you kidding?" she thought. "Really?" Reeves persisted. He went off to find a copy of their yearbook and returned within minutes. There, on page 195, was his senior picture, a smiling, much thinner, big-eared, greasy-haired Reeves. He showed it to Ruth. "I'm doing everything I can," he said, "all I can. We're interviewing everybody, everybody. I wish I had more, but Ruth, I'm doing everything." "I think you guys are covering something up," she said coldly. "That's what I heard." "I'm not like that," Reeves insisted. "I'm not covering anything up. That's not how I work. I'm doing everything, everything possible. Ruth, you know that. And if you hear anything, anything at all, call me. Please call me." They exchanged a few pleasantries, and Reeves went back to his friends while Ruth wandered through the crowd, occasionally finding a familiar face through the emotional fog. Reeves doesn't remember the evening all that well, though he wonders whether he had too much to drink and seemed overbearing to Ruth, or had apologized too profusely for having nothing new to report. Ruth, who remembers the evening only slightly better, has the distinct memory of Reeves pursuing her that evening, repeatedly reassuring her that, "I'm doing everything, everything I can." Reeves introduced Ruth to his friends, and though he said nothing about Eric's death, she felt that everyone knew. Wherever she turned, people were whispering, she thought, "That's the mother of the boy who drowned. You know, Eric McGinnis. What was he doing in St. Joseph? He must have fallen in. It's so sad." The conversations, however imaginary, enveloped her. She felt claustrophobic. Without saying goodbye to anyone, she found her way downstairs and left. But even then, as she walked to her car in a light rain, her umbrella raised, she remembers Reeves trailed her. She turned on him, she recalls, and scolded, "If you spent as much time investigating my son's death as you've done following me, you'd find out what happened." Reeves doesn't remember that occurring. Maybe it's because he had drunk too much. Maybe it's because it's what Ruth wishes, she had said. Ruth went on by herself, leaving Reeves to return to the gathering. When she reached her car by the marina, it suddenly occurred to her, as she looked out over the water, that she was a stone's throw from the river that took her son. And as she turned to the right, She saw through the darkness and the gentle shower the Coast Guard station where her son's body had been discovered. Her remaining strength gave out. Her arm in the umbrella fell by her side, her chin dropped to her chest, and dripping strands of hair clung to her neck and cheeks. A river of tears mixed with the rain. All she could think of, all she could visualize, was what it must have been like to come upon her son's body, bobbing like the boats before her, waterlogged and lifeless. How could anyone possibly understand her loss? And as for Reeves, though Ruth would never know this, the discovery of their connection, however tenuous, made the enigma of Eric's death that much harder for him to bear. He looked so grim when he returned to the festivities that a friend suggested they leave and retire to Babe's Lounge, a local police hangout. They did, and Reeves drank so much that he felt it for 2 days after. "It's hard for me to talk with Ruthie," he once confided to me, "because I don't have an answer. I feel for her as a parent. Maybe I get too emotionally involved with people." But the truth is that Reeves did have some answers, at least answers that he felt contained a measure of certainty. So did Ruth. The Gangsta. Ruth McGinnis was haunted by a desolating thought that Eric had died as a result of foul play at the hands of another black. And she had someone specific in mind. She felt it so strongly that she went to Reeves, whom she did not at this point trust, and Reeves, perhaps because of that wariness, vigorously pursued it. To understand why Ruth believed that Eric may have been killed by a black, it is necessary to keep in mind what the scholar and author Cornel West calls the monumental eclipse of hope, the unprecedented collapse of meaning, the incredible disregard for human, especially black, life in much of black America. If one spends time in Benton Harbor and St. Joseph, one can't help being aware of the turbulence of one and the tranquility of the other. For all the fears of St. Joseph's residents that crime will spill over into their neighborhoods, it hasn't. Most of the victims of Benton Harbor's sometimes frenzied environment are blacks. The root of such behavior, admittedly perpetrated by a small minority, but one with a disproportionate impact on the rest of the community, undoubtedly lies in deep and layered soil. Poverty. 45% of Benton Harbor's households receive public assistance. The breakdown of family. 62% of the town's families are headed by single women. The unraveling of community. The major institutions, including the newspaper, the hospital, the YMCA, and the federal offices, have moved to St. Joseph. The loss of hope. An estimated 29% of adults are unemployed. And, of course, just plain foolish, self-destructive choices. The whites of St. Joseph certainly had reason to fear for their safety when visiting or passing through Benton Harbor. Two of the more highly publicized murders during my visits were those of a white truck driver who was shot by a 19-year-old over a few dollars, and that of the white assistant manager of the Red Lobster restaurant on the outskirts of the town, who was brutally stabbed. But the blacks of Benton Harbor also had reason to fear for their safety, all the time. So it was not a stretch for Ruth to believe that, in a town which in 1 year recorded 20 homicides, 80 shootings, 50 stabbings, and 600 reports of shots fired, Eric had been the victim of a brother's frantic fury. That is what Ruth had most feared, that even though Eric was a decent kid, he might be drawn into the anarchy of the town's gangster youth. Kathy Miller, Ruth's friend and co-worker, gave me more background and history. I was at Deer Forest Park. There's this girl there. She says, "Everybody said everything about Eric, but I know the truth." And I said, "Oh, do you?" I never let on who I was or anything like that, and she says, "Yeah." She says to me that somebody in the police force had said that Eric was at the club, and there was a girl there. She was a Caucasian. And Eric had gotten to a confrontation with some guys in the club, and she said that the guys had chased Eric. And another version came up that Eric had stole some money out of a person's car. Did you ever hear that one? And it said one guy took off to chase him, and then another one chased him. And then Eric had got caught against a dead end, and he had a choice of getting killed or jumping. And then there's Ruth's theory, that some black guy killed him. Did she tell you that? She thinks that a black guy killed him because of something that happened out there at the housing complex. I think she blocks out that whites could have killed him, because she's close with a lot of white people. and to believe that they would do something like that to her child is unperceivable. Indeed, shortly after Eric's death, Ruth told her boss, Dick Miller, "I don't want this to be a racial issue. Eric got along with too many people. I have too many friends on both sides of the river." Miller was one. After Eric's death, he paid to have one of Ruth's brothers flown in from Seattle for the funeral. At company gatherings, Eric had taught dance moves to the children of some of Ruth's white colleagues. And after Eric's death, Ruth received her greatest comfort from a support group of parents who had also lost children. The group, which met in the basement of St. Joseph's First Congregational Church, was, with the exception of Ruth, all white. One longtime member, Harvey Johnson, a dentist who had lost his son in an auto accident, was especially important to Ruth. On her first visit to the group, she lost her nerve and turned to leave before entering. Johnson ran up behind her and called her name. Ruth started to cry. He said, "You're going to be okay," Ruth told me. He just took me in his arms, held me so tight. I just busted out, broke down. I couldn't figure out how I was crying, and here are all these people who were crying. But I learned. It was very hard for me to cross that bridge and go over there, but I got to tell you, it was the best thing I ever did. Ruth got along. She had to. She lived in Benton Harbor. She worked mostly with men and women from St. Joseph. She trusted so much that she didn't hesitate to call on the white-owned funeral home to handle Eric's burial. And she was dismayed by the heightened abuse in her own community. "The more I saw what was going on the news," she told me, "I could see something like that happening to Eric." One afternoon, a few weeks before his disappearance, Eric had come home from school sulking. He barely mumbled hello before going up to his room. Ruth followed him. "What's going on?" she asked. "Why aren't you outside playing basketball or something?" "Eh, I don't want to," Eric said as he flopped face down on his bed. Eric told her that another boy from the apartment complex had been threatening to hurt him if he didn't stop dissing the guy. Eric loved to score on friends and could easily get carried away, though he told his mom that someone else had been egging the boy on, whispering that Eric was passing on rumors about him. Eric was not particularly streetwise, though at times he crowed to others, particularly in St. Joseph, that he was deep into it. In truth, he wasn't particularly savvy in the streets. He didn't smoke marijuana, according to friends, nor did he run with the gangs, nor did he like to fight. "I'm the fighter," Ruth told me. "He's not. He'd run from any type of conflict." Ruth asked him who the boy was. We looked out the back window, and there he was. He was older. He was like 18 already. So I went out, because 8 or 9 months ago, this kid had been over to the house. He'd been down in the basement playing records and stuff. And I'm just thinking about me being a teenager, this stuff happens, and then they're back friends again. I went out and told him, "Hey, Dennis, what's going on? Why are you and Eric arguing like this? What'd he do to you?" And he says in a bully tone of voice, "Well, you know he had no business going back and saying so-and-so about me." And I says, "Come on. You've been in my house. You've ate my food. You don't need to be doing this. Come on, you guys make up. Come on in. Come on in." So I brought him into the house. He came in and we talked for a minute, and they said, "Okay, we'll be cool." They shook hands. Everything was okay, I thought. 18-year-old Dennis Marshall, a high school senior, had recently moved in with his aunt, Lucy Brown, a neighbor of Ruth's. He had fled the gangs in his hometown, Aurora, Illinois, a blue-collar city of 100,000, 40 miles west of Chicago. It's not that he didn't want to join them. It's that he was in with them too far. A member of the Black Gangster Disciples, Dennis had lost friends to gang violence. He had had a rival place a .357 Magnum to his temple and pull the trigger. Luckily, the magazine was spent. At that point, Dennis worried that they'd come after his mother and younger brother. So at their urging, he went to live with his aunt in Benton Harbor. When I finally tracked Dennis down, he was 24, living in Kalamazoo, and working 50-plus hours a week, tagging clothes at a pricey clothing store. He had, he readily conceded, served time for possession of a gun as well as for robbing a convenience store, but he claimed, and certainly appearances bore him out, to have chosen a new path. We met in a basement apartment he shares with his cousin. 6 feet tall and muscular with a silky complexion, he is a handsome young man. Dennis remembered Eric, though he says they weren't particularly close. They shot dice together and played basketball. He said Eric was a wannabe. He acted as if he was in tight with the gangs, when in fact, he wasn't. Eric would greet Dennis with a "What's up, GD?" as in Gangster Disciples, or he'd give Dennis the gang's handshake, which resembles, however slightly, a pitchfork, the disciple's symbol. He tried to represent, Dennis said. I told him, don't represent something you don't know nothing about, because one day you might have to go to the penitentiary. He tried to impress by trying to be hard, talking big shit, what he can do and what he can't do, like women's, like he a player. Like he can have this many women do this to him and get their money, you know, breaking them. Take you to the mall, buy you clothes. Yeah, he talked about it. He tried to be somebody he ain't. Eric was a prankster, a bit of a misfit, a kid who hadn't figured out who he was or who he wanted to be. He was cool, Dennis said, but sometime it get on your nerve. Calm down with all that clowning. A few days after Ruth admonished Dennis and had him make up with her son, Eric's clowning went too far. On the bus back from school, the two sat across the aisle from each other, and Eric started flagging Dennis's new do, a haircut shaped in a high box, the top dyed burgundy. What are you doing with a building on your head? Man, that Kool-Aid shit wear off? And on went Eric. Dennis, who had a temper, stood up, as did Eric. They faced each other in the aisle. I'm gonna bust you in the mouth you don't stop flapping them lips, Dennis warned. Nah, it ain't gonna happen like that. Dennis was, to use his word,